Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, what's $35 million? That's the amount Massachusetts gaming regulators are fining Wynn Resorts for not disclosing allegations of sexual harassment.
Anything that you say the word million behind it is probably pretty substantial in the eyes of most individuals. In terms of the company itself, probably not so much.
Also today, filmmaker Ken Burns, Hampshire College alumnus, on why he thinks the school is worth saving.
Hampshire College was transformational. It wasn't transactional. It completely rearranged all my molecules.
And President Obama's inaugural poet, Richard Blanco, on what it means to be an American.
It was this wonderful moment of finally feeling, as I told my mother, I guess we are finally Americanos.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Wynn Resorts will pay a $35 million fine, but the company will be allowed to keep the license for its Encore Boston Harbor Casino in Everett. This, despite the Massachusetts Gaming Commission's serious concerns about the company concealing information during the application process about sexual harassment allegations against the company founder and then CEO, Steve Wynn. Here's Gaming Commission Chairwoman Kathy Judd Stein this morning.
We're profoundly disturbed by repeated systemic failures and the pervasive culture of non-disclosure. To help ensure future compliance and indeed to punish for transgressions, the Commission has imposed a series of penalties and conditions.
They're also personally fining Wynn's current CEO, Matt Maddox, $500,000. The company still plans to open the $2.6 billion Everett Casino in June. Here to talk about this fine in context with me is Las Vegas Review-Journal reporter Rick Velotta. Rick, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me on.
Also with us is Boston Globe columnist Joan Vinaki. Joan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Rick, I'd like to start with you. I know you've been covering the tourism and gambling industries there in Las Vegas for nearly three decades. Are you surprised by this $30 million fine? $35
million. Actually, I wasn't too terribly surprised. I thought it might be a little bit more, and I think a lot of the people that watch the gaming industry suspected that it could have been higher than that because there was this sense that the Massachusetts Gaming Commission meant business on this, and they really were disturbed by some of the things that had happened, and that they would actually try to, fine them a little bit higher, make the penalty even greater than it was.
And that is a record penalty. It beats out the $15 million penalty levied against Wynn for essentially the same violations. $20 million for the same violations. Why were you expecting? Talk a little bit more about why you were expecting this to be even bigger. Because this is a drop in the bucket of what this hotel casino is expected to bring in each day.
Sure. I think that it went to the fact that the investigation that went on for like more than a year. Obviously, the people in Massachusetts were very concerned about what was going on. I received numerous comments from people from the Boston area suggesting that they did not want to have Wynn Resorts as the licensee for that particular property. So I know that the Massachusetts Gaming Commission really wanted to send a message, make a statement, not just to Wynn Resorts, but to any other gaming company that did any kind of business in the state to, let people know that we're not going to tolerate this kind of stuff. And the fact that it was just $30 million, to me, it kind of speaks to the fact that this is a big dollar industry that you're right, it's going to bring in a lot of additional money to the state.
And the fine for Maddox, that half a million dollar fine, that's about 2.9% of what he made last year of his total compensation. Joan, I want to get your initial reaction to this as well.
Well, I basically agree. I mean, I don't think the license was ever really in jeopardy, but I think there was an expectation that the fine would be a lot bigger. And in the days leading up to this final release of the report, there was a lot of speculation that Matt Maddox would be found not suitable. So in the end, the $500,000 fine that he has to personally pay is a huge amount to the average person, but really comes down to kind of a slap on the wrist for him, I believe.
And Wynn Resorts has not really commented publicly about this decision. They've said only, quote, that they are, quote, in the process of reviewing it, end quote. Rick, you've been covering this company for a long time. How do you think the employees and the leadership are processing this?
I suspect that there's a lot of relief in finally knowing what the outcome was going to be. You know, even though it's been suggested that it was possible that they could have lost their license, I think most people in the industry and most people, matter of fact, thought that that wasn't going to happen. There was just too much at stake, too much invested already. They're already have hired a number of employees. They've already started to book reservations for people. This wasn't something that was going to be reversed very easily, because that would have just put everything to a halt. And then who knows what would happen next? It might take years to sell the property to whoever the next owner would be. So I think that go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I think that as far as the Wynn executive staff is concerned, they're relieved. I think that the people that the employees are also probably relieved, because they've gone through a lot in the past year, with all these stories swirling around them about harassment and some of the issues that were brought forward, and also confident that Matt Maddox and his team was going to do the best that they possibly could to lead them through this very tough time for the company.
Rick, what do you think this means for Wynn going forward? Do you expect to see this sort of similar thing happen every time they try to open a new casino or apply for a new license? And not just Wynn, other casinos as well who may be facing these kinds of issues. Do you think that this is a warning shot, or do you think that this is a relief to everyone that this is something that's probably, as Joan said, a slap on the wrist?
It's probably a combination of both, because the fact is that they have made it through, and let's be real, they successfully made it through this process. But at the same time, they're going to have that stigma attached to them every time this comes up. Anytime sexual harassment comes up, anytime a licensing in another jurisdiction comes up, they're always going to be scrutinized, and people are going to point to this record fine in Massachusetts and the record fine in Nevada and say, gee, is this really a company that we want to become involved with? You know, they could say just about anything to mollify whoever the regulators might be. But the fact is, there's always going to be some doubt brought upon by just this series of events that occurred over the last year and change.
Joan, you wrote in a column last month, quote, as long as Maddox is CEO, Wynn Resorts should not get to keep the casino license, end quote. Are you satisfied with the decision to fine him personally $500,000?
Well, it doesn't really matter, you know, if I'm satisfied or not. I mean, the Gaming Commission was. I mean, I do think, you know, his tenure as CEO is really interesting. He was handpicked by Steve Wynn. Even the Gaming Commissioner's questioning of him was really, really tough. He looked kind of dishonest and dodgy while he was answering the questions. There's been a lot of speculation about sort of tensions between him and Elaine Wynn. So it will be interesting from, you know, the corporate side, you know, like what happens with Wynn Resorts. There's also been talk about tension between the local team in Boston or Everett and Las Vegas. So, you know, what happens there. But going forward, I mean, I think there are real questions here for the Massachusetts Gaming Commission. They didn't ask Wynn Resorts a specific question back when they were applying for the license. You know, did anybody pay millions of dollars to, pay off women who accused Steve Wynn of sexual assault and harassment? Because they didn't ask that specific question, Wynn Resorts didn't provide the information. Mm. Going forward, they should really kind of fine-tune the questions that they're asking people that are seeking licenses here.
And do you have faith in the commission going forward, Joan? Do you think that they've learned their lesson from this, or do you think that this may be a perpetual problem?
Well, they have a new chairwoman now appointed by Governor Charlie Baker. Their integrity, their credibility has kind of been called into question. So, they have something to prove as well going forward.
And the fact that the casino is already built and it's ready to go, do you think that has tied the commission's hands, Rick? I mean, in this case, do you think because there was already a plan to open in June, as you said, people have been hired, everything's ready to go, played a big factor here?
I think it did. Obviously, the commission and probably everybody else who lives in Massachusetts doesn't want to see a situation where, thousands of people who have been given a job are suddenly put on the unemployment line. That wouldn't sit very well with a lot of people. Although, I also understand that there's this question of integrity and going forward, whether the Wynn Resorts people or any other gaming company can be trusted, because you don't ask the right questions at the time of some kind of a suitability hearing. How many different types of questions you have to ask? One of the things I noted that in this, this decision that was reached was that they pretty much emphasized that anything that comes up like this, they need to self-report. And obviously that's something that it's a little bit hard to do for certain companies, because they wonder, well, gee, is this serious enough a situation that I need to self-report it, or is this something that, they're going to take the call and say, yeah, okay, we got it. But fine, that's it.
Yeah.
So I think they're going to be probably going to be a lot more cautious, especially when dealing with Massachusetts, just because of the fact that they have this mandate to now self-report anything that of any substance that comes up in the future.
And Rick, I want to make a note that we did reach out to the Massachusetts Gaming Commission, and they declined to be available outside the press conference this morning after this fine was announced. Las Vegas Review Journal reporter Rick Velotta, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
And Boston Globe columnist Joan Vinaki, thanks as always for being with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Tonight, the Boston School Committee will vote to confirm the next superintendent of Boston Public Schools. It's been 2 weeks since the three finalists were announced. Last week, each finalist spent a day being interviewed in a public setting to allow for parent and community participation. WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin has joined us, and he's been following this story. He attended those interview sessions, and he's with us now. Hi, Max.
Hi, Kimberly.
So we've been hearing from community members that despite this process to try to make things more open and inclusive, they still feel frustrated that parents and stakeholders weren't made a part of this as they should have been. What Can you explain that for a little bit?
Yeah, I think that that charge was long in developing. There was some frustration months ago in the fall when African-American parents complained that there wasn't an independent black parent representative on the search committee. Then you had the citywide parent council, which is kind of the most venerable parents group in the city. And they said this process has been kind of rushed and that a lot of parents they spoke to didn't even know what was going on, let alone have time to make an informed decision.
And are you also hearing specific complaints about the process leading up to tomorrow's vote?
Yeah, I think this final
tonight's vote.
Yeah, tonight's vote. This final phase has frustrated people as well. You had I spoke to Lisa Green. She's an organizer with a new group called the Boston Coalition for Educational Equity. And she said you saw a distinct lack of multilingual, serious engagement and outreach in advance of these live stream public interviews last week. And then you sort of those came in pretty suddenly, mostly during the workday and just after school vacation when people were finally getting back into gear. And it resulted in a particular scene. Let's hear from her.
When you look at the interviews that were supposedly organized for parent and community engagement, each night you ended up with a handful of residents in the room and a sea of empty chairs. You know, so it's disappointing. BPS knows how to engage communities across the city. Yet in this most important decision, the city made a choice not to fully engage the community and not to create the conditions for working class families to participate.
Now, Kimberly, to be fair, I think the district did indeed like live stream those interviews. The press was there. I was there with a lot of other reporters. And the search process hasn't changed that much from the one they followed 4 or 5 years ago that surfaced the past superintendent, Tommy Chang. But I think it shows the gradual deterioration of trust in the district.
So as we mentioned, there are three finalists, and it seems that there is a public consensus sort of forming around one, Dr. Brenda Caecilius. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I think Brenda Caecilius feels like just what the doctor ordered to the people we've just described because, that you know, she sort of made her mark saying, I'm a communicator. She said, I'm skeptical of high-stakes testing. I want schools to be this kind of community port where families are connecting with housing and health services. And she just sold herself as a listener, I'd say, a team builder, someone who can listen to a lot of constituencies and synthesize their goals. And I spoke to some people who'd worked with Caecilius in the past, and they say that's true. For instance, Denise Speck was the president of Minnesota's largest teachers union, where Caecilius was the education commissioner until the start of this year. And she said Caecilius worked really hard at that as she revised the state's plan for evaluating school quality.
And there are also negatives. Are there anything working against Caecilius's bid?
There's one prominent negative in the sense that she's in the final round under consideration for the top education job in the state of Michigan. At the same time, they're planning to have their final vote in another week. Mm-hmm. And she irked some of the people there for failing to show up in person for her interview. Of course, she was either in or on her way to Boston at that point. But I think it's telling. She's had almost every job in education. She's been a paraprofessional, teacher, assistant principal, and commissioner, head of all state schools. But she hasn't been a big district superintendent. And I think there are some locals who say we really wanted somebody who's done this job before and shown some success at it.
All right, let's take a look at the other two finalists. Marie Izquierdo, you can help me.
Izquierdo.
Izquierdo, thank you for that. She had her interview last Monday. She's the chief academic officer of Miami-Dade County Public Schools. What's jumped out about her to you?
Well, I think you saw Izquierdo's big district experience. Miami-Dade County Public Schools have about more than 350,000 students, much larger than Boston. I think that experience shows she came into town really prepared, really confident. And she felt like the most business-minded of the three finalists. She was thinking about public education in terms of consumer choice, in terms of supply and demand. And I think you can hear that in this clip. Izquierdo is discussing all the children who live in Boston who choose to enroll in charter schools or private schools.
18,000 students, I believe, are choosing something other than BPS. You can only attract those kids back by having high-quality choice options within your BPS portfolio.
Now, Izquierdo then went on to recommend, quote, right-sizing the district, which would mean closing some schools, refocusing at the remaining schools to make them more high-quality, more rigorous, more cost-effective. And I think that speaks to Izquierdo's training. She was a fellow at what's called the Broad Academy last year. It's a program that educates people to become big district superintendents, and it's been criticized for having a kind of corporate curriculum. But then again, Kimberly, BPS has this longstanding budget deficit, and maybe that kind of business mindset would be appealing to some school committee members.
And Max, do you see any other weak spots for her?
Well, I think she might have come on a bit strong. Florida has been this very particular educational environment, kind of a hotbed of reform since at least back when Jeb Bush was governor. There's no cap on charter schools there. And I think Izquierdo might have taken for granted, that we all agree on things that might actually be massively controversial here in Boston, like closing schools, forming alliances with businesses, things like that.
And the third candidate, Oscar Santos, is the principal of Cathedral High in the South End and a longtime Boston area resident. How big of an advantage does he have being from the hometown?
A week ago, Kimberly, I would have told you it was a big advantage. Santos was on this big splashy Boston Herald front page with an op-ed about why he wanted the job. And then you've got the board of trustees at Cathedral, the school he runs, that's populated with some prominent, pretty influential Boston business leaders. So he seemed very well connected, and I thought that might give him an edge. But I do think people find his professional record to be a little more limited and more mixed in results than those of the other two finalists. People on the school committee, I guess, will have to decide what kind of experience matters to them. Do they want work experience or do they want the kind of Boston experience, familiarity with the city that can have kind of a steep learning curve?
Right. And that familiarity can be a benefit, as you pointed out, but it could also, familiarity sometimes can breed contempt. Is that going to be held against him?
I think that's an apt expression. People remember that students walked out of Cathedral just last year. They were protesting Santos's firing of a popular basketball coach, the lack of teacher diversity there. And in 2013, Santos signed on to a project that I think looks controversial in retrospect, called for the elimination of the cap on charter schools. And that proposal was, listeners will remember, rejected pretty forcefully by voters back in 2016. And finally, there were people who thought he was a bit too hard charging during his 3-year tenure as the superintendent of Randolph Public Schools. I spoke to Ann Barish. She was a history and social studies coach when he arrived there. And she says Santos essentially eliminated her position as he tried to make over what was then a struggling school district.
Oscar's leadership style was abrasive, was blunt. He set people against one another. And again, in thinking about this, I think it came from him being green.
That's green as in inexperienced, Kimberly. Randolph was the only place where Santos had served in or has served in upper administration. And I want to be clear, two former school committee members there say Santos really needed to clean house, needed to be a bit tough in that district, and that there was a bit too much complacency, maybe patronage, too little oversight there.
And we know that the mayor, Mayor Marty Walsh, doesn't have an official role in the selection, but friction between Walsh and Superintendent Chang was a big factor in the departure. And Walsh does have the power to appoint the school committee members who will be making this decision. So any idea how much influence he has over all of this? And has he tipped his hand as to who he thinks is the best choice?
Yeah, it's interesting. Walsh has talked about this a little bit in the past couple of weeks. I think he would say he's sort of first among equals, Kimberly. He talks to the finalists. He talks to the school committee. He talks to trusted advisors. And then he forms an opinion that he kind of tells people about. And I don't think there's necessarily a problem with that. This is a district that for now is organized around mayoral control. Last time around, Walsh kind of went out of his way just a few hours before the vote to formally endorse Tommy Chang. Chang then won the vote a few hours later. Some people said, well, that was the mayor putting his finger on the scale. I think you see Walsh's influence this time around in more informal ways. You had all the candidates talking about the need to advocate for more state funding for city schools. That's really high on Walsh's political agenda this term. And most of them talked about a process he's overseeing, namely the restructuring and maybe the closing or consolidation of some schools.
And after hearing from all the candidates in just a few seconds we have left, is there any hint at who the favorite is?
I think, again, Kimberly, I might have said a week ago that Santos had the edge just because he was familiar. And there is a sense that Boston has been pretty rough on people who were coming from the outside. I think I probably did say he was the favorite on our air at some point. But now you've had multiple groups, Latinos for Education supporting Izquierdo, Citywide Parents Council supporting Caselius. Not as big a profile, an endorsement of Santos. I think at this point, the vote's a few hours away. I think I'd be foolish to guess. People who are interested can stay up and watch.
Okay, well, we'll be watching as well tonight. That's WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin. Max, thanks so much for the time and insight.
Thanks, Kimberly.
Hampshire College will make additional cuts to its workforce to help offset financial trouble that has made the school's future uncertain. On Monday, interim president Ken Rosenthal said that 24 faculty will be laid off. The layoffs are part of the college's effort to stay open and independent, which also includes a fundraising campaign led by one of the school's most well-known alums, documentary filmmaker Ken Burns. Ken Burns graduated from Hampshire in 1975. He spoke with us about what sets Hampshire College apart.
First of all, I think so much of higher education has become transactional, and that's a bad thing. And the Hampshire College was transformational. It wasn't transactional. I don't recognize the person who entered Hampshire in 1971 and the person who emerged in the spring of 1975. It completely rearranged all my molecules, and I am steadfastly devoted to its model, to its experimenting nature, to its even to this crisis as an opportunity to reinvigorate what I think we do better than anyone else. And I think because we're in the top 4% of colleges in the United States that its alums go on to get PhDs, we're also really well positioned to confront a lot of the problems of immigration, of climate change, of diversity, of gender, of the things that bedevil so many other people with traditional educations. I think Hampshire is well suited. Hampshire students are well suited to go out in the world and solve those problems, or at least making a meaningful contribution to making those situations better.
And you talk about being transformed. You made your first documentary while a student there about the lives of rural Americans, and that clearly spurred your interest in history. Now you're one of eight members of the President's Options Working Group, which is looking into different options for Hampshire's future. The members are affiliated with the school, but not directly involved with the day-to-day operations. How many times have you met, and so far, what does the group think the right direction for the school is?
Well, in fact, the group has met several times, but my role that's much more important to that is I've just recently agreed to be the co-chair of the development committee that is charged with raising an extraordinary amount of money to get us through the next 4 years. And so as head of the co-head of the development effort, I identified for myself a figure that really hurt, a contribution that would really hurt, and then I multiplied it by four. And I've reached out to the Hampshire community and asked them to do the same. If you can give $1,000, give $4,000. If you can give $250,000, give $1,000,000. And that way, we will be demonstrating to the rest of the world, which is rooting for Hampshire to win, those philanthropists and those foundations interested in education, and particularly the kind of innovative education that Hampshire has pioneered, will help us get over this hump. And so we're kind of very excited. Reports of our death are greatly exaggerated.
And how much money are you hoping to raise? What is the need there?
It's a significant amount of money for us. It would be, you know, a week's interest for Harvard. But we have to do anywhere from $80 to $100 million in the next 4 years. And that changes or goes higher or goes lower depending on certain circumstances. But I'm sort of rolled up my sleeve, as have thousands of us, and are committed to solving this problem and really beginning to use this crisis as an opportunity to help reinvigorate the Hampshire model and make it more not just sustainable in a financial sense. It's a kind of perfect storm of demographics and other aspects of that negative transactional world of higher education that has put us in this position. And I think we have that opportunity to emerge stronger than we've ever been before.
And you're talking about this fundraising campaign, but as one graduate, Jessamine West, points out, not everybody who graduates has the wherewithal to do that. She told New England Public Radio that, quote, most of us are tree-hugging, follow-your-dreams kind of people, which means a lot of us, as much as we might want to help support the school, aren't necessarily rolling in it and may not have much to give. What do you say to her?
It does not matter how much you give. I would like to identify each person, to identify that figure that hurts, and then multiply it by four. It is really important that everybody realize that that kind of spirit that she describes of being out there trying to do good is in many cases not going to deliver people the kind of incomes that those transactional institutions are kind of in some way preparing their students for. We're adaptive and we're innovative, and absolutely that's the case. There's no shame. This is why I won't publish how much I'm giving, because I don't want in any way this to be any kind of contest. It may be that somebody that gives $400 has hurt more than somebody who's given $400,000. If you can see it in increments of four times hurt, then you have the ability to help be part of a wonderful bit of news, a great headline, which is Hampshire College safe and out of the woods.
Now, the New England Commission of Higher Education has indicated that the college's accreditation is at risk, but acting president Ken Rosenthal says he's confident that the school will be able to meet the accreditor's standards. On Monday, he laid out personnel changes in a letter to the Hampshire community. The school will lay off 24 staff members, and another 47 staff members are taking voluntary leave or leave of absence or will reduce their appointments. Does your group think that will be enough, and do you think that's the right way to go?
This is a necessity. We are shrinking by necessity the number of people in the college, and that means we can't have as many staff and as many faculty. And I believe, as does Ken Rosenthal, that the accreditation will not be changed in any way, and we're very confident that we'll be able to meet their requirements.
Now, there are a lot of small liberal arts institutions, small private colleges across the country that are in crisis. There isn't the same demand for them as there used to be, and some have had to close their doors. It's inevitable in a way. What is it about Hampshire College that makes it different?
First of all, we're not immune to those kinds of pressures that have forced the closure of other places, but I think of all of the smaller colleges that offered a kind of alternative, we were the most vigorous. And I think the proof of it is in, if you just walk the campus today and see the quality of students and the way they've got their eyes fixed on the future, if you look at the alums that are, really, stepping up to the plate and helping out in a big way, you begin to understand that Hampshire meant for all of us something incredibly unique, that it wasn't just preparing us for a particular career rut or lane that we would be in, but taught us how to see and how to live and how to cross over the many lanes. And so you find Hampshire College students incredibly adaptive and incredibly innovative. And that kind of entrepreneurial, in a way, spirit invests all the disciplines, whether you're a doctor or a lawyer or going to become a documentary filmmaker. And so I think that Hampshire, just by sheer will and sheer creativity in its original inception and its willingness to always innovate, will get it through this period. And all of us are now at the position of stop sort of arguing over what might be going on and getting down to the business of how do we actually save the college.
Are there other alternative things that you're looking at, perhaps partnerships with other institutions, for instance, or moving some of the space involving public education or community engagement appropriate? Does Hampshire have to stay in its current independent state for it to survive?
We have decided that that's what we want to do, but the Options Committee, when it was regularly configured with the previous administration, was all about helping to advise in the consideration of a multiple number of options. And so while we won't rule out some options, we have elected collectively to go with this independent model, which we believe we can do. It will probably require down the road some partnerships, but none that would jeopardize our independence and the secret sauce that we think we've got and the message we want to proclaim to the world that if you wish to escape the sort of transactional aspects of higher education, you do no better than to come to Hampshire College.
That's filmmaker and Hampshire College alum Ken Burns. He's on the President's Options Working Group at Hampshire College, which is working to help the college endure its current financial troubles and carve out a future for the school. Thanks for your time, Ken.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, poet Richard Blanco on his new book, How to Love a Country. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Finally today, we're going to spend some time with poet Richard Blanco. The Maine-based poet was the youngest, first Latino, first immigrant, and first openly gay person to serve as an inaugural poet. Here he is reading a portion of One Today at President Obama's second inauguration ceremony in 2013.
We head home through the gloss of rain or weight of snow or the plum blush of dusk, but always, always home, always under one sky, our sky, and always one moon, like a silent drum tapping on every rooftop and every window of one country, all of us facing the stars, hope, a new constellation, waiting for us to map it, waiting for us to name it together.
Richard Blanco is out with a new collection of poems, How to Love a Country. He'll be at the Charles River Museum of Industry and Innovation tonight, and he joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be here, Kimberly.
Thanks for being here. First, Richard, listening back to that poem in 2013, what comes to your mind now?
Oh, just looking at the crowd and like just a sea of people. But also, you know, it's surprising. It was the first moment that I really had to I had a little over a month to write the poem, three poems actually, asked me to write. So it was the first time at the actual inauguration where I got to breathe, and I realized there's a little Cuban-American gay kid from a working-class family that's going to read a poem to the entire nation, and it's me. And it was this it was the first time I realized this, how special that moment was. And so I was overcome by a sense of gratitude, but also what that moment represented for so many people like me who never weren't quite sure we were part of the American narrative in that moment. So I was honored in that moment as well to sort of thinking about all those little kids like me in this country and what that moment meant.
And your current collection is called, as I said, How to Love a Country. And the first poem in that collection is called Election Year. You write about tending a garden and the uncertain, the garden you cherish and the uncertainty around it. Will it survive in your care? Do you think that the United States will survive?
I'm hopeful. I'm optimistic that yes, as long as the institutions stay intact, as President Obama always says. Yes, that poem is sort of an allegory for the garden is our democracy and we are the gardeners. And it's also sort of also saying, you know, sometimes we do things right and the garden doesn't. There's a temporary lapse in the garden, and being from up here and being from Maine, sometimes those hostas just don't come up when you want them to come up, right? So I am hopeful that as long as we stand by the democracy and understand actually that we need to maybe participate in that democracy a little bit more, need to tend that garden a little more closely, that yes, I am optimistic that we will survive. And I think what's been happening in our political climate lately, in a way, you know, there's been, of course, things that I certainly don't agree with, but there's also been a lot of people that have just stepped up, you know, that have stepped up. And I found it beautiful because they're not stepping up just for things that matter to them personally, but that matter to us all. When the ban on Muslims was being put in place or whatnot, there were people just coming out of the woodworks, and it wasn't affecting them personally. It was saying, no, this is not who we are as a democracy. And I thought that was a good sign.
In the book, even before you get to the first poem, there's this opening that you call Declaration of Interdependence, where you blend lines from the Declaration of Independence, interspersed with new lines. What were you trying to say here?
character.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I didn't want the book to do is just be a one-beat kind of book. I didn't want to just preach to the choir. I wanted to do what poetry can do best, which is open up another dialogue, another conversation, and realize perhaps where we have all failed, right? And so, and also in that particular poem, I just wanted us to, you know, this polarization that we have has just permeated every single part of our lives, right? And so, we can discount or object, abstract and discount entire states, entire regions by what color they are on a presidential map, and we're not talking to each other. We feel like we've created this behemoth political class that we're not. We can only speak through party lines, and I wanted that poem to sort of break up or make us think about that a little bit, and so. To not make assumptions, to get rid of the stereotypes, to realize that there are good and bad people in every place, in every world, in every situation, to have more empathy for each other. And when I was reading the Declaration of Independence, I realized that we could almost send it word for word to Congress today, because we kind of like the same kinds of demands that we have been making seem to be keep on going nowhere. So there's some language in there that's just absolutely beautiful. But also the idea of interdependence versus dependence. And I think we need to move as a country from this idea of independence and me, I got mine, you get yours, you know, to the idea that we're all interdependent. And I think speaking to your first question, if we're going to survive, I think we need to also, as human beings, individually sort of come to that conclusion in our psyches.
And in your collection, you tackle a number of issues from politics to immigration, race in America, growing up gay, the Boston Marathon bombing, the wall, border security. I mean, how do you pull all this together?
Well, you know, How to Love a Country is a statement. It's also a question. It's also a how-to book. It's an examination of everything that happens in a country and the complexities of all that. Throughout the last 5 years, I've also been doing commissioned or more occasional poems. As a result of the inauguration, I just started thinking about what is the role of a poem in our country? What is the role of the civic poet? What is the role of a more socially conscious kind of poetry? And so I just looked for opportunities where poetry could speak to that, including, like you were saying, the Pulse nightclub shootings, the Parkland High School shooting, but also moments of celebration, Freedom and Mary, and that's a love poem from my own partner who just a couple weeks ago asked me to marry him finally after 20-something years.
Congratulations.
So, you know, I wanted to also celebrate what's going right. And so all this sort of mosaic of what makes up a country, it's a complex question, right? I mean, there's so many parts to it, large and small. And so there's still sort of some very autobiographical poems, too, that deal with my own sort of smaller, tighter focus on my relationship and with my country.
And I want to get to one of those poems. I would love if you would read it to us. Its title is El Americano in the Mirror.
Right. So just a few words about this. So I also wanted to implicate myself in the book and realize that in some ways we're all capable of fear out of ignorance, and we're all capable of sort of making odd and decisions and judgments about people. So I'll just say that. El Americano in the Mirror, for Derek. Maybe you don't remember, or don't want to, or maybe, like me, you've never been able to forget. May, 1979, fifth grade recess. I grabbed your collar, shoved you up against the wall behind the chapel, called you a sissy Americano to your face, then punched you hard as I could. Maybe you still live as I do, with the awful crack of my knuckles slam on your jaw and the grim memory of your split lip. Why didn't you punch me back? That would have hurt less than the jab of your blue eyes dulled with pain, how you let your body wilt, lean into me, and we walked arm in arm to the boys' room, washed off the blood and dirt. Is that how you remember it? What you can't remember is what I thought when our gazes locked in the mirror, and I wanted to say, I'm sorry. Maybe I love you. Perhaps even kiss you. Did you feel it, too? At that instant, did we both somehow understand what I'm only now capable of putting into these words, that I didn't hate you, but envied you. The Americano sissy I wanted to be, with sheer skin, dainty freckles, the bold consonants of your English name, your perfectly starched shirts, pleated pants, that showy Happy Days lunchbox, your A-plus spelling quizzes that I barely passed. Why didn't you snitch on me? I don't remember now who told Sister Magdalene, but I'll never forget how she wrung my ears until I cried for you, dragged me to the back of the room, made me stand for the rest of the day, praying the rosary to think hard about my sins. And I did. And I have for 32 years, Derek. Whether you don't remember, don't want to, or never forgot, forgive me, though I may never forgive myself.
That's Richard Blanco reading El Americano in the Mirror from his new collection, How to Love a Country. Richard, have you heard from Derek, and do you know if he's forgiven you?
I've heard sort of, we were a very tight, sort of a small grade school class, so I know of him, and so I have yet to sort of present this poem to him. And that's always a scary thing, because it's interesting how memory, you know, in my mind it lives in some way, and that's kind of what the poem is taking up, you know. It was one of those childhood memories I just has haunted me all my life. And so I'm curious to hear his perspective, but I also I'm just wondering what that moment would be like. But I'm working on it.
And in many of your poems, including this one, you mention mirrors. Is there a function of a mirror? What does that serve in your work?
You know, it's interesting. That's come to my attention lately, and I think since so much of my work is about a quest for identity, belonging, home, place, I think this mirror starts becoming, the idea of a mirror starts becoming a motif, you know, how you're trying to find yourself, look for yourself. And yet in some ways a reflection is a reflection, but it's not your true self, right? It's a mirror image. And so I've been realizing that, yes, the mirror starts becoming a motif again, and thinking about how I see myself in others, how I see myself in this country, how I see myself in memory, how I see myself in all sorts of complex ways.
And I'd like for you to read another poem, sure, if that is okay. This one is titled titled Remembering Boston Strong. Of course, very important to our listeners here in Boston.
Yes, and that was, I believe, April 15th, right? If I remember that correct.
Yes.
Funny story about this poem. So I got to read this poem at the opening of the Boston Strong benefit concert, which was, in a way, a little more terrifying than the inauguration, because people were there to see Steven Tyler, not a poet, right? Bostonians, you know, we were all, everybody was sort of just celebrating the release. And so that was an interesting experience. Remembering Boston Strong. Years from now, you'll wish all you remember was how spring arrived just as you expected, the icicles gone as magically as they had appeared, the snow seeped back into the earth just as you had trusted it would, the thawed Charles and a river of runners ribboning that morning through the city that was a city long before our nation was a nation, while the ivy scribbled, climbed, turning green the red bricks your great-great-great-grandfathers laid, memories, mortar in every city wall and chimney. But years from now, you'll still remember this, the unexpected smoke that wasn't a spring fog, pink-purple blossoms mingled with the sparkle of shattered glass strewn over Boston Street, bursting red, red maples' tiny leaves opening like newborn hands to cup April's rain, the lives of two girls with names as pretty as Mayflowers who would never bloom, the irony of the race ending with the mangled feet and legs of those wheeled away by those who did not run away, and the boy, the son, everyone's son, his life outlived by the budding tulips of window boxes, dressing up the city suddenly frozen in spring. Daylight each day, a few minutes longer, but baseball diamonds dulled and muted. The sky each day a tint bluer, but stadiums abandoned, every seat an empty nest. The wind each day a hint warmer, but park benches cold and quiet, swings like pendulums stopped. Each night crickets louder in your ears, but winter still set in your eyes, caught in the glow of television sets, casting shadows of the news across living rooms and hollow city streets, locked down in silence. And years from now, what you'll mostly want to remember is not the shootout that ended the silence waiting, nor the bombers' names, nor the blast, but the tender roses you laid across the finish line, the thankful praise you gave for the lives that saved lives in their arms, the brave promises of those who vowed to walk, dance, and run again. The stadiums and ballparks again filled with anthems sung by you, like a thousand songbirds at once, a chorus into a second spring you had not expected. Dandelions still pushing through pavement cracks, spiders still spinning, forsythia still bursting yellow, elms still growing taller, and ivy still climbing the enduring walls of the city, still a city, but a whole lot stronger.
Richard Blanco's new collection is How to Love a Country. He'll be at the Cambridge Forum event in Waltham tonight. There's more information about that on our website, radioboston.org. Richard Blanco, thanks for coming
in
today.
Thank you.
And that's all for our show today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR station. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Join us tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.